So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Both guys out. Look at Heenan. He's up on the apron, and Virgil as well. Everybody's on the apron.
In the meantime, Jesse has stopped the count. There's no longer a count going on, Gorilla Monsoon.
Oh, look at that. What is this?
She took off her dress. She took off her skirt, Gorilla Monsoon. I don't
know. Elizabeth has shot everybody. Look at Jesse, he doesn't know what to do.
I don't believe her eyes.
Look at the $1 million man, he doesn't
know what to do. You don't know what to do.
Look at Andre, he's bewildered.
Everybody's shocked. Everybody's on their feet, Gorilla.
What a move by Elizabeth.
Is she ever lovely tonight, brother?
Oh, the cutting line over.
Get up. And the
man. Let it drop.
Get down there and count, Ventura.
Jesse, right there, one, two.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Review Away. John Pollock is not here today. He is busy, as we speak, watching every single second
of the G1.
Of the G1. You probably are already hearing a bunch of podcasts that he's already put out, but nonetheless, he needed a bit of a break. And, you know, I said, John, why don't you, you know, you were so nice to take on the extra workload, really at all times. This guy.
Yes.
Just,
I totally.
So he actually asked me if I could do this week, and I said, of course. And who better to bring on the show than somebody who I think has received great positive feedback anytime he's been on this show. So Dan Laransky.
Hey, Wade. How's it going? I'm glad to be here. I always love doing these every once in a while when you guys need somebody else to jump in. They're always lots of fun. And Wade even let me pick the show that we're going to review.
As always. Why wouldn't I? And what we are doing today is SummerSlam 1988. How did you arrive at this choice?
Well, I just thought, Wade, since the Battleground pay-per-view just wrapped up this past weekend and the next big show is SummerSlam, I thought it would be fun to go back. You know, SummerSlam is considered one of the big four with WrestleMania, the Royal Rumble, and Survivor Series. And I just thought it would be fun to go back and check out the very first SummerSlam because, as you will see, the product was very, very different back in those days.
It was. At the time, did you watch the WWE? You know, did you watch this pay-per-view live?
I believe I did, Wade. The only pay-per-view that I ever remember not seeing live was the very first WrestleMania, because I had no access to closed circuit at when that first one did. And I watched it on VHS a few months later. But all the rest of them, by this time, either they would have closed circuit venues in place, or because the product was so hot by this point, 1988, this is after WrestleMania 3, where the product was super hot at this point, and almost any bar or establishment, much in the way they will show UFC nowadays, they all showed the wrestling pay-per-views. Because, again, there wasn't a glut at this point either. This is, you know, that we're still building the empire. So it was very easy to find bars that would be showing these events.
So by this time in 1988, pay-per-view was already an established thing in most homes?
Well, no. That's why it was you had to go to bars. It was in existence, but it wasn't as common as it is today, okay. Where it's almost everyone has access to pay per view. Back in those days, it wasn't as easy as that, and usually the alternative, it was much easier to find an establishment of some kind.
So
that
you
would
went
show
to a bar.
It. Yes.
What bar? Do you remember?
Oh, geez. No, I don't remember what bar it would have been. This is 1988, so I would have been in university. I would have been in St. Catharines, so it would have been in a bar in St. Catharines.
Did you have like a bunch of friends who were also into going out? Like, because I work most of the UFCs now, but before we used to have to cover every single one, I would go out with all my friends, and it would just be a monthly occurrence of us going out to watch the UFCs.
Yeah, totally the same sort of thing. Absolutely. You just get some friends, get together, go have some beers, have some wings, and watch the show.
Okay. What were your impressions going into this show? Give us some context about what exactly was leading up to SummerSlam.
Well, it was pretty big deal. Again, the product was super hot at this point. We had just come off WrestleMania 3, which was huge in Pontiac, Michigan. Big deal. Big show. Let me think this through again. It's after WrestleMania 4. My mistake.
Savage won the title.
Right, that's right. Savage is the champion this time. It's after WrestleMania 4, right. It's in the summer of 88. And Vince, he had already had WrestleMania. He had created the Royal Rumble first for TV as competition for WCW. And same with Survivor Series. It was created as competition. And this one, it wasn't like that. It was more along the lines that Vince just wanted a show in the summer. He wanted a show in August with a summer theme. So that's where they came up with SummerSlam, and they were doing so well. And remember, there's only three other pay-per-views at that time, so it was not a big deal to add another one to the thing. And back then, like myself and my friends, we really looked forward to these pay-per-views because they weren't so common. It was only every few months, and we were very excited when one would happen.
See, like when I started watching wrestling, there were already the Big Four, or at least Rumble, Survivor Series, SummerSlam, and Mania.
Yep.
So it's hard for me to imagine a time when you didn't have that, pretty much that pit stop to build towards. I mean, Survivor Series just debuted earlier in 87 prior to this, so you really just had that and WrestleMania. So how did people, how did the company build up, to the next big event? What would that next big event be prior to there being SummerSlam?
Well, back in those days, Wei, they would work more towards the touring, the live shows, right? The focus of the television would be always towards the live events, and they would kind of have a bunch of angles in motion, and then they would take certain stories to certain cities, and that's usually what your buildup would be. Like you'd have your matches, and then you'd have your local parts put in, like say with Billy Red Lines telling you what's coming up in Toronto, and the storylines that you would see on the television would lead to what the events were at the live. So it's similar, except that would be just for the different various markets where they were doing live shows. It wasn't one, like, for one concentrated event, because when they would do a story, they would, like, tour it like a rock band. Mm-hmm. Like, the one I remember big time, because I went to one of the shows in Buffalo, is they did a feud with Hulk Hogan and Killer Khan, and it wasn't part of the big stuff on TV, really. They just did a couple angles to introduce it, but they toured that match everywhere. That match played everywhere, and they would do usually about three different shows. The first one would come, and it would end in some kind of schmoz and something, and then they'd have a second one where, Khan would do something. He threw the mist in Hogan's eyes or whatever, and then the third one was the gimmick match, the Mongolian stretcher match, and then that would be the one that Hogan would win with Killer Khan getting taken out on the stretcher. So it was more towards working the various whatever they were going to do in a certain market, is that's how they would kind of gear the TV, and then they would add in the local stuff, which would really hammer it home.
Had you seen this show since that time?
No, this was the first. I had gone back to it since watching it originally, and I have to admit, I did have a lot of fun watching it, although I did groan in a few places too, especially every time Superstar Billy Graham opened his mouth. But other than that, I actually enjoyed going back to it because I hadn't seen it.
And was Superstar Billy Graham one of the reasons why you chose the show?
It was one of them. I really did want to do the first SummerSlam just to give some of the younger fans some context, because I thought it would be fun. But I figure I wanted to see how much you could endure of the superstar.
Yeah, I've never seen this show. To be honest with you, though, he wasn't that grating to me until the last hour, because I think I've just, like, grown up in an era
where all the commentary is bad.
And you just like learn to tune him out.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, he just sounded like background noise to me.
Okay.
And I didn't really pay as much attention to it.
Well, the thing that caught me, and I didn't realize this the first time at all, but Superstar Billy Graham basically ends every single sentence with, there's three options. First off, it's, he's got him in a headlock, brother. And then there's, he's got him in a headlock, Gorilla Monsoon. And then there's, he's got him in a headlock, Gorilla Monsoon, brother.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically it. And there's one point in the show, I forget what match, where he just gets hooked on the Gorilla Monsoon. And he says it literally. This is not an exaggeration. He literally says it at the end of every single sentence. He says Gorilla Monsoon. It's just crazy.
He needs to remind himself what
who he was talking to.
Dan,
I think
Lebransky.
Okay, waiting. You can tell right away that they're not crazy about Billy Graham, because if you saw the open of the show is Gorilla and Superstar beside each other, and Gorilla says something, he throws to Superstar, and Superstar just rambling. He's not really saying anything, and Gorilla has to literally cut him off and get them back on track again. So you can see right out of the gate, it was not the best choice.
What exactly was happening in Superstar Billy Graham's career at this point?
He was pretty well done. We see Don Morocco on this show as a later gimmick, where they called him The Rock, actually. Mm-hmm. And Superstar Billy Graham had been his manager at first when they first gave him this Rock gimmick, but then his injuries were and kind of years of abuse were even at this point in 88 starting to catch up to him. He was having trouble with his ankles, because he had done steroids, and in a period when, you know, the 70s, people didn't really even know what was going on with this kind of stuff and the ramifications of taking it.
Oh, God, Jesus, you talk about Scott Putski candidates. This show, all these shows from this era in the WWF, I think will have a very hard time picking a winner.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And I remember the first big one with Graham was his ankles. He had real trouble with his ankles because his legs had just been so big, and he was constantly messing up his ankles. And Vince was always such a mark for Superstar Billy Graham that he tried to keep him around as much as he could. He tried to put him in programs. He tried to use him, but he just ended up getting hurt all the time. And then eventually the two of them had a falling out at one point, and
but at least at this point, Vince decided to transition him into the commentary.
Yeah, I think Vince was under the impression that, and he's right. I mean, he was awesome doing promos. You find old Superstar Billy Graham promos, they are spectacular. He was really good, and I think Vince just thought, well, if he's that good doing promos, he must be good doing commentary. And as we've seen, that doesn't always translate. Just because you're good on the mic does not mean, I mean, I think of that classic example where they gave Arn Anderson a shot, and he was on maybe 2 weeks, and they took him off. And rightfully so. He was not good as a commentator. I mean, one of the best promos ever, but just didn't really have it as a commentator. And same with Billy Graham. I felt that Billy Graham was just kind of rambling a lot of the time. Like, he wasn't really thinking. I don't know.
I'll tell you what really got to me eventually was just, there are no peaks and valleys with his commentary.
Yes.
Like, I found he was always at a 12 out of 10. And it was a bit of a headache to listen to at times. But it's not like he was awful. Like, I think there have been far worse commentators, for sure. But I thought,
I would think a lot, actually, you know, you're probably right. I think some of the guys even today are worse at doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? So
it was hardly an Art Donovan situation.
That's true. It's nothing as train wreck as that.
So let's get into the show. SummerSlam 1988, the very first SummerSlam. This took place in Madison Square Garden. We are first treated to a great opening video. Not very much like the ones we see today, but this one featured stop motion images of the main eventers. Of course, this whole pay-per-view is built around the Mega Powers, Hogan and Savage, taking on the Mega Bucks, Ted DiBiase and Andre the Giant. And so this whole opening video was like the classic, the theme, this theme was...
That's the original SummerSlam
theme. SummerSlam theme. It was also used for what, the Rumble?
Yeah, I believe it was used for a couple different things back then. The music, yeah, I mean, they weren't associating with bands or getting bands like they have today to do a song for every pay-per-view. It was more Jim Johnson, the house guy, doing his generic, you know, triumphant kind of music, right?
And this opening video was as simple as, you know, pose, guys. Guys, we need you to pose, and we're gonna do a stop motion.
Yep.
It was as 80s as you could get.
Yeah.
We are, of course, introduced to our announcers, Gorilla Monsoon and Superstar Billy Graham, who are announcing from the top.
They're not ringside, right.
Billy Graham was wearing this amazing shirt.
He always had spectacular style. Lots of bright colors and stuff.
It was not tie-dye, but what it was some type of tank top with an airbrushed face on the chest. I'm talking like the whole face.
Yeah.
What took place on his chest. And instead of like painted hair, he had like glittered strands for hair. I don't know whose face this was.
No, you know what? I don't know who it is either. Yeah, I'm not sure.
But I don't know where he got this shirt from, but it was definitely the standout part, I'd say, of his appearance on this show. Our first match, the Bulldogs, the British Bulldogs, taking on the Fabulous Rougeaus. Now, you know, I did some research prior to watching this show, and many articles stated some real-life animosity between the Rougeaus and the Bulldogs.
Yes. Well, yes, there's the great stories in, when we had, this is going back in law history, but we had Jacques Rougeau on many, many years ago, and he explained the whole thing. Yeah, they did not get along. Tom Billington.
Something about a Kurt Hennig rib gone bad.
Yes. Kurt Hennig, I can't believe if he cut the clothes, I can't remember if he cut the clothes or did he do the defecation?
No. Yeah, one or the two.
Yeah, it
was the cutting of the clothes.
Okay.
From what I read, and just correct me wherever you see holes in the story, no pun intended. But Kurt Hennig, at one point, the Rougeaus were in the locker room, and there's always a wrestler saying how you should get somebody to watch your
clothes.
Watch your gear. And so Kurt Hennig's like, yeah, I'll watch your stuff. Meanwhile, he takes the Rougeaus' clothes and he cuts them into ribbons.
Yeah. And Kurt Hennig was a notorious ribber. Like, he was one of the worst guys in locker rooms for pulling ribs on people and then trying to shift the blame to somebody else.
See, this is
else.
The type of stuff I wish we could see on Swerved. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, I watched Swerved. It was pretty lackluster.
Anyway, so the Rougeaus get back and then Kurt Hennig pretends to have just gone to the bathroom and then didn't see who did this. And of course, for whatever reason, the Rougeaus immediately blamed the Bulldogs. And so, I don't know, I guess the words were exchanged. No punches were thrown or anything. But then Dynamite obviously got really upset about this.
Because he was a real hothead, Tom Billington. And he got worked up over this.
And he eventually found Jacques and started just punching him repeatedly backstage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, many accounts state, you know, they're just completely confused. And this later led to an incident where
Sucker punch.
The Rougeaus punched Dynamite
sucker punch
in the mouth, apparently with a roll of quarters.
Yeah, and they totally suckered him, like he did not know. Because they waited like 6 weeks. Like Jacques talked about it in the interview.
Oh, slow burn.
Yeah,
nice.
He waited. He wanted him to kind of like forget about it and stuff. And then when at the time was right, he was going to cork him.
That's what I would do.
Yeah.
That's something I would do. If somebody cut my shirts up, I'd probably wait. I'd probably wait a year.
Exactly. So it's out of their mind. They're not thinking about it. That's exactly was his thinking.
So then he that actually it knocked out Dynamite's four teeth.
Yes.
And then just a lot of animosity in the backstage build up to this event. However, they were able to put their differences aside to have this match.
That's the thing. If you watch the match, there's really no hints of that at all. And in fact, it's probably almost, in terms of in-ring, this is probably the best match on the entire show. I mean, this, to me, was one of the few matches on the card that holds up, that would fit in today's environment. Like, you could show that to a young fan and they wouldn't be thrown off, whereas some of these later ones
Hercules.
Or, you know, Ken Patera and Bad News Brown, you know, at some of these later matches, not so great.
Well, the Bulldogs always seem way ahead of their time in terms of their speed. And I thought this match was no different. The Rusos had recently turned heel beginning
this,
there.
We gotta talk about this.
Yes.
This, please. I loved this at, in the time. Me and my buddies would get little flags and we would take them to the live shows and we would wave them just like the Rusos. There's nothing I like more than the smarmy heel. For those of you that need a modern picture, the Rusos were just like the New Day. It was that same sort of false sentimentality. They would talk about, oh, how great the U.S. was and how great
these
Canada
were. These
was.
Were Canadians working a faux pro-American gimmick.
The Rougeaus were famous wrestlers from Quebec. Both their fathers and uncles had been big-time promoters and stars, and Vince was very quick to bring them in. And they're like the Bulldogs, excellent in the ring, really good ring workers, could work with almost anybody and make them look good. But this was the epitome of, yes, the Canadians doing the pro-American gimmick. They had Jimmy Hart with them at one point as their manager, and in their infamous theme song from the time, the lines about Montreal to Memphis and Parlez-vous Francais, and
we didn't get the song, unfortunately.
No, yeah.
The only songs that were played were the people that came out second.
Yeah, so they were already in the ring, unfortunately, but it was just one of the best heel gimmicks ever. I totally loved it, and any time they were on TV, I was entertained for sure.
The Bulldogs arrive with Matilda, who gets her own platform to sit on ringside.
Vince was very into animals back then. I mean, look at it. We had Jake with his snake. Ricky Steamboat had an actual dragon alligator on some shows. They teased Bad News Brown having a big rat at one point.
I wonder why they don't do animals anymore. Like, what?
I would assume there's probably rules in place that don't allow that kind of stuff anymore. It's
Matilda looked like she had great treatment. She had her own little throne.
Yeah,
there.
She was, and she was, you know, a good sized dog. They were definitely taking care of her.
I wonder how they got her to sit so still in front of so many people.
Yeah, obviously it trained to some degree. I'm not sure where the dog came from. It wasn't the Bulldog's dog, obviously, but it did manage to stay still during the match.
When are we going to get an animal wing in the WWE Hall of Fame?
I would think Jake Snake would have to go in first.
Frankie? Damien.
Yes, there you go. There's
for
another
sure.
one. Coco Beware with Frankie.
Pepper.
Yeah.
Al Snow's dog.
I don't know if that one deserves
induction.
Yeah, I don't know if that one deserves to go in myself. That was not one of their better angles, I have to say.
We go to the match. Some good back and forth action. There are many tag matches on the show, four of them, including the main event. And I'd say they all pretty much followed a very similar WWE format.
Yep.
You know, come back.
Isolate
back
a guy,
and forth,
work,
exactly.
work him, work
hot
one
tag.
Guy over, hot tag. Yeah. Yeah.
The Rusos start working on the left leg of Davey Boy as they tag in and out, and they ground Dynamite for a large portion of the match. A lot of, you know, rear chin locks. Again, frequently tagging in and out. Finally, Dynamite just headbutts Jacques in the gut, chops him, gets the hot tag. Davey Boy comes in, military presses Jacques, and drops him right on the top rope, crotches him right on the top rope. Davey Boy then launches Dynamite across the ring with a military press. And, there's a lot of great action. I pretty much just kind of summed it up very quickly.
It was. Like I said, it's definitely a match worth checking out because I think it stands up still even in this modern era.
But the bell rings because the 20-minute time limit has expired. By far the longest match on this show.
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was great. A really good opening match. I have no problem when it's a time limit draw like that, especially when it's two strong teams. You want to keep them both strong. They gave you 20 minutes of intense action, and you can have a rematch after that.
Was that the idea to, you know, continue the program, or was there more to it? Was there anything? I mean, considering the backstage drama between
right.
the two, was
as far
to
as
that?
I don't know if there was anything in terms of that. I mean, if you watch the match, there's no hint of it at all. They're mm-hmm. all four of them are very professional in the ring. There's nothing crazy going on, or no. Crazy shoot shots just to get revenge on somebody. Yeah.
I really liked watching the Bulldogs in ring here. Just, you know, like you said, they just seem so far and above the rest. I mean, Dynamite
they
in
are.
Particular
yeah.
seems so far
yeah.
above everybody else, maybe with the exception of Brett, mm-hmm. you know, who we later see on the show.
Right. And even Brett at this point is still not quite where he would be later on. You know, he's still in the tag team picture as well. But, yeah, Dynamite, one of the, you know, at that time, bringing in in that an influence that today we see quite a bit of from Mexico and Japan, but back then very, very rare, especially when Vince loved big guys. Yeah. You didn't see guys doing crazy headbutts off the top rope and stuff.
As somebody who, you know, didn't grow up watching Dynamite, but grew up watching a lot of Chris Benoit, these two looked almost exactly the same in just even the way they would deliver punches or a chop or a vertical suplex. You could just tell Benoit really completely mimicked his style.
He was basically his wrestling idol, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was incredibly impressed with Billington. Saw him back even in the early days of Stampede. Was a very big influence. Oh yeah, and that's the thing you watched. He did all so many of Dynamite's moves: the diving headbutt, like the chops, like everything. Very, very, very similar. Very big influence.
We get a recap of Superstars where Brutus the Beefcake, who was supposed to challenge the Honky Tonk
right.
Man for the IC title
yeah.
and what was supposed to be billed as his last chance at Honky Tonk's IC title, he was on Superstars and he was attacked by Outlaw Ron Bass,
yep.
who drags Beefcake around with some rope hanging him, cutting him open. He's blading. What was notable here was that we got the big censored red X across the screen, so we couldn't see exactly what was going on.
No, but you notice they let you see a little enough of the
yeah.
blood just to let you know there was blood,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, I love that.
Back at this time, way much like today, very much a PG oriented product, very much aimed at
oh,
the
yeah.
family.
Oh yeah, this was evident in the main event.
Yeah,
oh wow, main event finish.
Ah, but it's still Jeez. Compared to what happened in the Attitude Era, the main event finish is nothing.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Most of the time they kept things pretty normal. I mean, you never saw. I mean, look at even when they had the cage matches back then, they used that big blue cage that looked mm-hmm. ridiculous. It wasn't the classic frost fence like we see
yeah.
today, you know.
But
so
this, I remember like watching Superstars. I suppose there are different rules when you're like showing TV.
Well, you got to remember, Wade, it was on Saturday afternoons.
Yeah.
We were watching these shows at like noon, 1 o'clock on mm-hmm. Saturday afternoon,
right after cartoons.
Yeah, exactly. Kids are all over it. Like you couldn't have. Although I have vivid memories of as a kid seeing bloody wrestling matches on TV
at that
but
time.
It was. Yes, but it was not WWF.
Right, okay.
It was stuff from the South.
See, I don't doubt that they might have done this for added effect. You know, when you bleep a curse word, it sometimes has bigger effect than actually
really,
hearing
exactly.
it.
Really, exactly.
And here, to see just a big red X
with
the
censored
word,
written across
with the word censored across it, leaving more to your... It's like when TSN used to cut to the crowd shots anytime we'd see
right,
like,
that's
two,
right.
an attack on women.
That's right. And now they make it black and white or something. Or is that TNA that does that?
WWE will... Do they do black and white? I don't,
is it
I don't
TNA
know
that,
do
that does that now, I guess, right?
I don't know. But
someone does... I think it's TNA. Whenever it gets bloody, they should show the footage in black and white, and I never understood that.
But I mean, just to see a big, simple red X here leaves so much to the imagination. And I remember just as a kid, like, wow, like, what's going on here?
The one I remember, there's one from when I was really young, when before Vince took over, and we used to get Mid-Atlantic up here, and they had Roddy Piper. He hired Abdullah the Butcher to attack Wahoo McDaniel. And same thing, Abdullah busted him open, and they put the big censored thing across the screen. You couldn't see the blood. And yeah, me as a little kid, I'm like, oh, what's going on? What's going on? I want to see, you know.
I don't know if it's something that would work today, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. We go to our next match, and it's Bad News Brown taking on Ken Patera. You know, give us some context, Dan, on both men at this point in their careers.
Well, this is very interesting for Ken Patera, because if you notice, Ken Patera was the babyface, right? And Ken Patera, you know, back when he started, he was always an excellent heel, trained by Vern Gagne, spent a lot of time in St. Louis under Sam Mushnick, where he kind of developed his character. But at this point, Ken Patera had just come back to the WWF from prison.
Really?
Yes, Ken Patera and Mr. Saito got in a, were, I don't know, it was after an event one night, and I'm guessing they were probably drinking and got worked up, and they went to a McDonald's, and they wanted to get in, yeah, they wanted to get in and get some food, and the McDonald's was closed. So, drunk Ken Patera and drunk Mas Saito, that's not good enough for them. They started throwing rocks through the windows and through the door, and the police had to be called, and the police had to subdue them. It took several police to subdue them both, and they both ended up in prison.
They must have really. I wonder what they wanted. Like, was it?
They,
like,
I think honestly, they were hungry and they were drunk. Way, like, and they got. They just got mad enough that they thought, well, that's it. We're going to trash the joint.
Maybe they wanted, like, a Happy Meal. Wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah, maybe Mr. Saito just wanted that quarter pounder or a Big Mac. And so, yeah, Patera ended up being in prison. I actually remember when this happened because a big match was booked at Maple Leaf Gardens that Ken Patera was supposed to wrestle. And they had to change it at the last minute, and they did special interviews on the TV with Billy Rhett, and they put Heenan in Patera's place because this had happened. And Heenan did a great promo, but I'm not a wrestler. I don't know what to do. Now you can't put me in this match. And even though they had to change it, they did something to make you even get more excited about it. Like, oh, wow, Bobby Heenan's got to get in now. He's going to get the crap kicked out of him, right? So that's what they did. And then he was away. And then when he got out of prison, Vince brought him back. But they did it as a baby face. And it's the idea that, oh, he's paid his dues and he spent time in prison and he's a new man now.
So they didn't shy away from acknowledging that he did go to jail.
No, it's the way I remember it, Way, and I could be wrong, but the way I remember it is they brought that up. They talked about
that. Did they mention that he broke the window?
No, they didn't. They didn't go into details of trashing a McDonald's.
Yeah, you would want people to think that it would probably be for a tougher reason than.
Yeah, no, they didn't go into details like that, but they just made it sound like, you know, he's paid his dues, he's back now, he's going to be a good, you know, and he was pushed as a good guy after that.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
and Bad News Brown.
Bad News Brown, again, Bad News Allen, when he wrestled in Stampede. That's where he came from. He first started in wrestling in Stampede. He had been in the Olympics judo. He was a judo guy. If you watch some of his stuff in the match, you'll see that. But he was a judo guy, and he had some success in the Olympics. And I can't remember if it was Stu Hart or someone got him started on wrestling, and he was a natural. He's one of these guys that was a natural, really good on the promos, very good at getting his character over. Like, I used to love his promos. Hmm. I thought he just did a great job. Very good look. Kind of your classic heel look with the black trunks, black boots. He used to wear these black kind of like judo gloves on his hands as well. Cool. That's basically his thing. So they brought him in, and of course Vince, you know, wanting to own the name, he had to change the name to Bad News Brown, but he had wrestled as Bad News Allen.
Nice. Okay, so not much Olympic technique here, I'd say. I mean,
oh, and did you notice they said Ken Patera was the Pan Am champion?
Yeah,
which I thought was kind of interesting since we're into the Pan Am
sport?
Games right
what
now.
Sport?
It would have been weightlifting, probably. Okay. Yeah, he was more of a bodybuilder, weightlifter.
Yeah, not much Olympian technique here. I really just found it to be a pretty straight-up, dirty brawl.
It was a lot of
stomping on the face, some body slams, some headbutts, just a lot of like old-school heavyweight stuff. Patera, to me, just really seemed almost like a man out of time here, especially coming after a Dynamite Kid match where, you know, this man, his big move was the bear hug.
Yes.
And there's been a lot of talk about bear hugs on this podcast lately, Dan. I don't know if you're familiar with this website. Bearhugger.net.
Oh, no.
It's a website dedicated to this one move.
To the bear hug.
To the bear hug. It's got an extensive archive of every bear hug that's ever occurred.
Well, again, when I was young, it was classic. You always saw bear hugs. Someone always had the bear hug as a big move in their repertoire. Usually bigger guys would do it. It's such a simple move to do. Like, it's not, you know, it's really... It doesn't hurt anybody that much. It's very simple to do. I mean, it's hard to make it look effective sometimes. That's the only thing. You have to really... Some guys' bear hugs look so light.
Who would you say had a very good bear hug?
Man.
Patera's look pretty good here.
Yeah, not bad.
I think one of the keys is that you... For me, at least, is that you tuck your head underneath your opponent's armpit and you put... Like your hug
right.
All the way across him.
Yeah, see that.
Otherwise, like when you're hugging him, like an actual embrace,
yeah.
It just looks awkward.
Yeah, Gorilla Monsoon used to do a pretty good bear hug, as I remember when he was wrestling. But any of those bigger guys like that, the bear Bruno Sammartino used to do the bear hug. Any of those bigger guys, that was always one of their moves. A lot of times. Guys, if I remember the way Bruno would do it, he would get the guy actually off the ground. The guy would kind of lift his legs, and then Bruno would have the arms around the midsection. Right. And that always looked effective. It's like, wow, he's lifting the guy off the ground.
Yeah. Here, the bear hug was actually recognized by the audience, you know, as a big spot. His other big move was a full Nelson.
Yeah, that was Ken Patera's famous one from day one, always the full Nelson.
Mm-hmm. He tries for the full Nelson time and time again, but Brown gets to the ropes, and we just go to the finish now. Just a pretty ugly Irish whip into the corner.
No, the ghetto blaster way.
Patera charges the turnbuckle, and he hits the post, and then Brown, yes, comes back with the ghetto blaster for the win at 6 minutes, 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's exactly what I would have expected with these two guys. At least it's kept short, right? It wasn't a long match.
Mm. We go to the backstage now where the Mega Powers are, and at this point, they are behind a terrible blue screen. I mean, for 1988, quite impressive, but not even a green screen, a blue screen back when we were still using those. Both men are just so sweaty, glistening. They're worked up over something.
Yeah, yeah. No, the tan. Look at Hogan's tan. Like, there was this period there in the 80s where Hogan, he just was so dark. That's like the darkest period of his tanning, I would have to say, right there. Yeah.
He's still pretty, like, he's always, I'm sure, been orange.
Like. Yeah, but I mean, that to me looks almost, like, now he doesn't look so...
He was like a nice brown, like a crisp brown.
Yeah, it looks almost unreal to me, the brown.
Like toast.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Spread some peanut butter on him.
So, the Mega Powers are backstage, they're worked up. Savage says they
well, probably little, you know.
Cold. They might have had.
No, that's not what I mean.
Laying in the beach and they're naked all the time.
That's not what I mean, Wade.
So Savage says they have a secret weapon, and it's Elizabeth.
Yes.
So
I'm somewhat foreshadowing what you're going to see in the main event.
Were you a fan of the Mega Powers as a concept?
Oh, yeah. No, I thought it was. I mean, I thought it was great. I mean, both guys were over so huge. I mean, I loved Savage. I was never a big Hogan guy. I thought he was great on the promo, but his in-ring I always thought was so disappointing. Whereas Savage was the complete package. I can remember me and my friends, we used to go to Brantford, the Civic Center, and they used to tape TV there for Canada. And they would do a whole month's worth of shows in one night. And it was basically squash matches. You'd see a big guy beat up a ham and egger. And we were there the night Savage made his debut. And right from the start, Way, we were blown away. Right away, we're like, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. He had the awesome robes, the big shades. He came out, he's jumping off the top rope. He was fast back then, Way. Like, mm-hmm. if you see footage of him from that back then.
He's still clearly the fastest guy in this match.
Yeah, he's so fast and so crisp mm-hmm. and just, We loved him right away, and then he cut a promo, and we're like, oh my God, this guy is amazing. Like, he was one of our favorites right out of the gate.
Up next, we got Rick Rude taking on the Junkyard Dog. Rude arrives with Bobby Heenan, and just fantastic. Anytime Rick Rude comes out, the cutaways to the women in the audience.
Yes, yeah.
Swooning in awe of this man.
Yep.
And
even though he was a heel, tons of women loved the guy, right?
And they must have, like, I don't know how it is. It's possible that they're able to find so many of these reactions every single time I've seen Rick Rude come out. But here, there are probably no less than, you know, 5-6 women in the audience that they did close-ups on, just in complete awe of this man. Rude takes the mic. He makes fun of the men in attendance and says he's going to show the ladies in New York what a real man looks like. He disrobes and shows off his tights, featuring an airbrushed image of Junkyard Dog on the front and the back.
Yeah, this was Rude's gimmick, right? And this is one of those things. It's such really a little thing, but it just made the gimmick so good. He would always do this. He would come out with the tights of whoever he was going to fight. I mean, he must have had quite the collection of tights with various people's faces on them, because they did this a lot with him, and it just added to his character. And he was, again, super good on the mic. A physique to die for. Like, I mean, look at the abs. And, like, I mean, he was just so good at, I'm the best-looking guy here, and I'm going to tell you all about it, and you're going to believe me.
And like, maybe the best mustache.
Yes, he had a good one. Yeah, yeah.
Airbrusher, we're getting a lot of work on this show between Rick Rude here and Billy Graham's shirt.
Yeah.
Rude attacks from behind immediately to start, but Junkyard Dog regains the advantage quickly and delivers his grounded headbutts to send Rude out of the ring early. Rude starts working on Junkyard Dog's arm. He tries this move where he arm bars the arm, and then he tries to like squash it with the weight of his body by sitting on it, but this doesn't work because I guess JYD was too strong, and so Rude is trying to convey that he had actually crotched himself on Junkyard Dog's arm.
Right.
It looked a little weird.
No, it didn't really work out, did it?
Rude then goes up to the top, and for the big finish, pulls his pants down.
Yep.
Pulls his pants down to reveal another set of tights underneath, and it is the wife of Jake the Snake Roberts,
right.
Cheryl.
Yes. Now, at this time, the angle had already started, right? At this time, what happened is Rude would come out on the TV, and he would do that whole routine, the gyrating and stuff. And they did it the one time that he was leaving the ring, and there was a girl in the audience, and he got in this girl, and he's waving the hips in front of her, and he's kind of getting in her face and everything. And we find out eventually that this is the wife of Jake Roberts, Cheryl Roberts, and he's trying to get at him. So this is one of those things. I mean, Jake was already babyface at this point, I believe. So this kind of just further strengthened him as a babyface. And that was the whole idea. And there were several times when after that he would come out with the tights of Cheryl and Jake would run out and try to rip them off and stuff like that. There was countless times when Rude got his tights ripped off and was flailing around in his underwear in the ring and stuff like that. So, and this, again, this was a great angle at the time. Like, to me, I still remember this angle so vividly, Way. I thought it was done so good at the time. It was very exciting. And it's one of those ones where it's like, you know, now I have trouble remembering what I saw last week because so much gets thrown at us. But back at that time, that was one of the angles that really, really stuck. And I think one of the best angles with Jake and Rude, both guys. They both did phenomenal in this.
Certainly the first time I could remember seeing a match finish with a man pulling his pants down on the top rope.
Yeah, it's funny because you think, how the hell are you going to jump with your tights down at your knees? Like, it's ridiculous, right?
Did it.
Yeah.
Does his move the flying fist off of the top rope with his pants down. But at this point, Jake runs out and sees the pants and just goes nuts. DQ finish. Rude wins. But Jake apologizes, of course, to JYD.
Yeah. The other thing about this one, too, is JYD at this point is really kind of a footnote. He's kind of past, well, he's definitely past his prime. I mean, his prime to me is when he was in Mid-South and he could really, really work with some of those guys like Kamala and Duggan and DiBiase and those guys. And by this time in the WWE, he's really slowed down a lot. He's put on a lot of weight. I mean, he really didn't do very much in this match. But you know what, I don't know if you noticed this, Way. Even though he's not one of the top guys anymore, when he does his signature stuff, the crowd pops.
Yeah.
Like when he went down on all fours and did the headbutt, the crowd popped. And he was really just a footnote at this point, right? Mm. So it's amazing how certain guys, even when they're at the tail ends of their careers and really not doing much, there's still certain things that people always loved about them.
Me and Gene Okerlund is in the back with the Honky Tonk Man. And the Honky Tonk Man says he knew Brutus wouldn't make it for his match, but Honky doesn't care. He wants anybody. And then Gene is trying to bring up rumors of a man with great physical capability answering the challenge. But Honky, like, Gene's about to reveal who it is, but Honky says he doesn't want to know. He wants it to be a surprise.
Yes.
Up next, we got the Bolsheviks taking on the Powers of Pain. That's, of course, Boris Zukov and Nikolai Volkov taking on the Barbarian and the Warlord. With Slick in their corner. Slick is in the corner of the Bolsheviks.
Yes, that's right.
Of course.
Yeah.
The Warlord. Multiple times Scott Putski Award winner for a reason. And also the man most nominated for the award, at least by Brad's last count, at 14.
Really?
Make that 15. Man.
Wow.
Any thoughts?
Vince, I mean, Powers of Pain, this is before Vince has been able to get the Road Warriors. He, I think, obviously wanted the Road Warriors because you see, not this team, but also another team on this show that are just blatant Road Warrior ripoffs, right?
Demolition.
Yeah, who are on this later on. And I mean, this match, all I have written down, it was just another brawler match. Like, it really.
Just a very typical heavyweight match with a lot of power moves. The Powers of Pain have Baron Von Raschke on in their corner on the outside, wearing a hooded robe.
Yeah.
Not really that all that intimidating. You know, just a very typical WWE match where a lot of isolating in the corner, tagging back and forth, hot tags. But the powers of pain execute their finishes, which were a power slam and a diving headbutt from the Barbarian, which actually looked pretty decent, and this all ended up in a 5-minute and 30-second
Again, you know, they were smart back then that these guys never got long matches. You don't give 20 minutes to the Powers of Pain and the Bolsheviks, especially Nikolai Volkov. Again, Nikolai Volkov, starting even by 1988, we have a guy here who has been wrestling since the 1960s, been wrestling since the late 60s, had a whole career as one of the Mongols in the 70s. Like, here's a guy that he's been around a long time, even at this point.
Up next, we got a segment of the Brother Love Show, who introduces somebody who says he needs to learn a lesson of love. And it's Hacksaw Jim Duggan, who comes out, no entrance music, but Duggan comes out with a 2x4, does a big hoe, and then proceeds to call Brother Love, a phony.
Yes, wow.
Calls him a phony. Brother Love says that Duggan needs to be more like Dino Bravo, a man who loves his country. And then Duggan says, the people of Canada don't like Dino Bravo, and don't you dare question my patriotism. At this point, you know, was Duggan doing the full-on pro-American thing yet, or was this sort of...
He's done it from day one, Wade. From day one when Vince brought him in, that was his whole gimmick, the 2x4 and I'm the American hero. Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's been doing it for a long time.
So really, that was the point of the whole segment. I mean, really...
I think this is the early days of pay-per-view. I think they're still seeing it similar to how you put across a television show. I mean, although there was an example of this exact same thing at Battleground this past weekend, too, when they did that stupid thing with The Miz and The Big Show, where it's just like it's a TV segment, right? And I just think they probably wanted to get Hacksaw on the show in some way. Brother Love character was somewhat hot. You have to remember, this is the era TV evangelists were in their heyday. There was controversy with a lot of them. Most of them were seen as shysters. It's funny because you don't see those guys on TV as much, but back in the late 80s, like, flip on TV on a Sunday night and there would be like just a plethora of these evangelists, and all of them pretty shady. So they were totally playing off that kind of mainstream. One of those things where wrestling taking something from the mainstream and making their own spin on it.
How did you watch this show? Where did you watch it?
Yeah, I have. A few years ago, they put out the SummerSlam box set.
DVD.
It was 88.
So did you get all the Sugar Ray Leonard Donnie Lalonde ads?
No.
Okay, this was at least on the network version, and from what I could tell in the live version, there was even more of this stuff. Titan Sports at the time were promoting boxing.
That's right, yes.
And all throughout this show, there were frequent mentions of the Sugar Ray Leonard Donnie Lalonde match taking place at Caesar's Palace sometime later. And this match was, like, more promoted than, you know, obviously the next one was Survivor Series, but that wasn't until later. But it was odd seeing boxing promoted on a
WWE show. It was something that Vince tried. I mean, Vince's grandfather, not his father, but his grandfather had actually been involved in boxing promoting in the 40s, right? And then got out, and then his father really kind of got out of it. His father wasn't as interested in promoting boxing. But it was a failed experiment. I mean, this was the only boxing match that Vince ever got behind promoting, right? I'm not sure if he. I think he, again, like today, he wants mainstream acceptance so badly, and he just wants to be part of that. And he'll do so many things to kind of embrace that. And I think he just fought with, you know, Sugar Ray being a very popular fighter, that he thought maybe if he got behind this. I mean, he's, you know, he tried to do the Bodybuilding Federation, which was a similar thing, failed. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but Vince was the promoter for Evel Knievel's jump over the Snake River Canyon in the 70s. So he always had was trying to get his hands into other areas to further the wrestling.
Do you think there's much crossover between boxing fans and pro wrestling?
I think back then there was.
I don't think
there is now. I think, you see, back then we had Muhammad Ali, we had Joe Frazier, and these guys had characters like pro wrestlers. You know, and you
can argue that these guys were just like probably just mainstream stars.
Oh, yeah. Would, you know, oh, Muhammad Ali was a total mainstream star. I mean, you didn't have to be a boxing fan to know who Muhammad Ali was.
Or even a pro wrestling fan.
No, no, yeah. Not at all. And Muhammad Ali, he had done that match with Inoki in Japan. He had done angles with the WWF before. He was at the first WrestleMania. There's that infamous clip when Gorilla Monsoon was still wrestling, and Muhammad Ali's at ringside, mouthing off and yelling at him, and he gets in the ring, and Gorilla gives him the big airplane spin on his shoulders and slams him, and Muhammad Ali gets up, totally sells it, kind of walking around like he's in a stupor. Awesome. Like, it was, I think the guys back then were just more, could lean themselves more to wrestling because they had characters where you don't really get the characters like that nowadays.
Sugar Ray Leonard apparently was at this show, but they didn't show him, at least on the WWE Network version.
That's interesting that the network version left all that stuff in.
They
I'm
do that.
Surprised
they do that sometimes.
That.
They, like, I mean, some of the network shows I've seen, they would leave in little ads here and there, and I think it might be just like probably whoever's cutting the show just wanted to leave it as like sort of a slice of the
history. Yeah, well, definitely when they show the old Clashes of the Champions on the network, they'll always, because they leave everything, even Mean Gene's pitching the hotline and that, and they'll just put a little thing along the bottom saying phone number no longer.
If you're trying to call
a
show from 1990,
I know, you'd think, you know.
You deserve to get a dial
tone. You deserve to get burned.
Come on.
But so, that's cool. No, definitely for the DVD, any of that kind of stuff was not in there, no.
Up next, Honky Tonk Man taking on a mystery opponent for the Intercontinental Championship. Of course, at this point, Honky has been the champion for 454 days.
Yes, more than a year. Yeah, more than a year.
A year, 2 months, and 25 days.
I believe longest run of anyone.
The longest run.
Up to that time.
Yes, in IC title history.
Yeah.
I think even until now.
Yeah.
So Honky comes out, grabs the mic, says he doesn't care who his opponent is, and then
that music hits. That
famous music. It's the Ultimate Warrior. The Warrior just comes out, charges, bolts right to the ring, and the fans go nuts. Warrior goes even more nuts. Match starts, delivers a really ugly clothesline.
Yep.
Bounces off the ropes, delivers a splash, and pins the Honky Tonk Man in 31 seconds, ending the longest IC title reign in history.
Now, see, this is how you get somebody over. This was huge at the time, Way. Warrior had come in. He'd been around for a while. I mean, you know, he'd been around for not that long, really. And really, all we had really seen out of him was mostly squash matches on the TV, which are actually very similar to this. He'd come out and, you know, it was all presentation with the Warrior, right? It was that music, that running to the ring, that shaking of the ropes, the tassels on his arms, the great physique. It was never, never about in-ring with the Ultimate Warrior, right?
Mm-hmm. But it didn't have to be.
No, that's right, because he had great presentation. And, well, as you see, this show is pure evidence of that. That's one of the reasons I wanted to do this, because it's so different from today, where in-ring is so important, and the fans of this generation have been brought up on strong, good in-ring. Not like that when I was a kid. It was more about the characters and the presentation. A lot of times the match did not mean that much.
So if they gave a Warrior type of push or a Goldberg type of push to somebody today, you don't think it would work?
Oh, no, I'm not saying that at all. It would work. They'd have to do it properly.
But I feel like fans today are savvy enough to be able to see through it. I mean, just even look at Roman Reigns, you know, like people.
But the Roman Reigns push has not been the Ultimate Warrior Goldberg push.
No. But I feel like even if they did give that to him,
I think if you had the right,
would reject it.
I don't know, Way. I think if you had the right guy with the right charisma and you pushed him properly and kept him strong, I think it would work. I mean, I was very skeptical that Rusev would work in this day and age. I really did not expect he would work at all. I thought that's too old school. The fans are going to crap on it. They're just going to laugh. But they booked him strong and it worked really good.
Yes, but Rusev is also technically sound. You know, like, I just wonder.
Okay, I suppose.
In this time where everybody's watching.
I see, so you're
NXT.
Saying someone that couldn't perform in the ring.
Yeah, like, okay, I don't know if fans would, you know, see one of these Ultimate Warrior clotheslines and, you know, still be able to cheer the way they did back then.
You know, you're probably right. If the guy was, if he was Ultimate Warrior bad in the ring, then you're right. I think you would have some problems.
But I completely agree with you that, you know, if you're going to end a streak in memorable fashion, this is the way to do it.
Absolutely. It was such a big deal. Again, because, for us at the time, there has that great lineage. Savage had it. He had that wicked match with Steamboat. Steamboat won it. And unfortunately, Steamboat wanted to take time off and Vince wouldn't let him. So Steamboat had to drop the belt very quickly to Honky Tonk. So there was that lineage of those guys recently that all had had it. And then, yeah, here's a guy that's had it for like over a year, and he still got it. It was just such a big deal at the time. And it, really, this is where the Warrior, this is where it starts. Mm-hmm. Like, really, this is where it starts when he won that Intercontinental title. And I'll just tell you this. Mm-hmm. One of the first interviews I ever did for The Law was with the Honky Tonk Man. And I asked him about this. And he told me it was his idea for the match to be 35 seconds. Because he did not want to be in the ring with the Warrior any longer than he had to be. He was really worried. The guy was super green. He thought he was going to maybe get hurt. So he actually went to Vince and said, can we do this super fast? And Vince thought, yeah, that's a great idea.
I really feel like if this went any longer, it wouldn't have added anything. It would
no.
have been probably more detrimental.
So. I agree. He's a new star. This is a big deal. Short, fast, big impact. And I mean, look at how the crowd reacted, too.
The crowd
went nuts. Yeah.
And went nuts. Arguably the most memorable part of this show. I mean, I would say,
yes, probably watching it then and historically. Mm-hmm. Historically, I would say it's the most important match. Because, again, I wanted to, that's another reason why I picked this, because I wanted some of the younger fans who might have only know him through his recent induction and what happened with the WWE Hall of Fame. They might not know. And that was the point. That was the launching pad.
We have a brief intermission where I think on the live broadcast they probably showed more Sugar Ray Leonard promotions.
Okay.
But I
thought something was up, because on the DVD it goes to black and then it comes up again, and I'm like, okay, something's been taken out
here. Intermission. Heenan comes back when we come back from intermission. He interrupts the announce booth and he sits in for commentary for the very next match, which is Don Morocco taking on Dino Bravo. Don Morocco wrestling as a babyface at this point.
Yes, this is starting to get towards the tail end of his WWF run. They were pushing, he used to be kind of like the beach bum character. And you'll notice he came out in the tie-dye. That's the association with superstar Billy Graham when he had been his manager for a while. That's when they changed him from kind of the beach bum thing, and they started to call him The Rock just because he was so huge. Morocco was one of those guys where his physique at a certain point just ballooned. If you find old pictures of him from when he first started, he's quite a small guy. But by this point, I mean, he's just huge. He's huge in this match.
He is huge. Both men.
And again, same with Dino Bravo. Wait, if you find older pictures of Dino Bravo, much smaller guy. This was obviously, you know, some sort of medication here was being used.
Yeah, these guys weren't cutting weight.
No, they're sure. Adding weight. No. And it's weird how I think they're both great examples of how it works with the physique, especially Dino, because his physique kind of looked strange, kind of weird, like
just like comic book like.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
So we get here, Heenan and superstar Billy Graham pretty much kind of take over on commentary here, arguing between the two of them. But at least they're arguing about the people in the match. Heenan grills Graham about, you know, being the manager of Don Morocco and, asking him if he's upset he's not accompanying Morocco to the ring. And they just kind of like, they argue back and forth a lot. How did Don Morocco do as a babyface?
It was not memorable at all, Way. No, and it didn't last very long, as I remember, either. They tried to do this thing with The Rock, and it didn't really catch on. No, it was not a good. I thought he was much better. I liked him as a heel much better. He kind of did those old school ranting and raving type promos, but I did like Morocco more as a heel.
Not much of a match. Don Morocco, Frenchie, the manager of Dino Bravo, is on the outside holding a sign that says the USA is not okay. So Morocco attacks him on the outside. Back in the ring, he tries to lift Bravo for a slam, but Bravo gets out and hits his side slam for the win. Just another very 80s stereotypical WWF heavyweight style match.
Honestly, at this point, a filler match. Like, there's no real. And the other thing that's weird about that is they set up all that stuff with Hacksaw and Brother Love, and he didn't. I thought maybe Hacksaw was going to be a factor in this, right? Because they got set up all that stuff.
Did they mention Morocco or
Bravo?
Bravo?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
He said, remember, Brother Love says you need to love your country, like Dino Bravo loves Canada and that.
Up next, we go to Sean Mooney, who's in the back with Jesse Ventura. And Jesse Ventura has been appointed the special guest referee in tonight's main event by Jack Tunney. And Mooney recalls an incident previously where Jesse accepted money from DiBiase. And Jesse denies accepting the money, but says if someone is going to stuff money in your pocket, you'd be a fool to take it out.
Yes. The story here is that why this was interesting was Jesse had been away for a while at this point. This is when he got his little bit of a Hollywood run there, and he went and did Predator, and he did Running Man, and he had just recently come back again. So this was kind of a big deal to us fans because we hadn't seen Jesse for so long, and I missed him. As soon as he left, I missed him. Because I think, you know, him and Gorilla together, I thought were awesome commentary team. I really enjoyed them. And even this promo, like Jesse's so smart. Like, it's like, oh, you've been appointed by Jack Tunney. Well, first thing out of his mouth, because he always used to take pot shots at Jack Tunney, it's first time Jack Tunney's ever made a decision that was right. Like, Jesse was just always so on the money when it came to cutting his promos.
Did he return to the commentary booth after this?
I think he did. I think he did for a little bit. Yeah, I think he did for a little bit. He did for a while, because he didn't go to WCW till early 90s.
Up next, we got, for the tag team titles, the Hart Foundation taking on the champions Demolition. And the Hart Foundation at this point were working a feud against Jimmy Hart, who were, of course, leading Demolition.
Yeah, and Hart had been their former manager, right? So, yeah, they're the baby faces in this match.
The Demolition come out in their dominatrix masks. They are the defending champions. Brett and Axe start off the match. Brett then starts to take on both members, and at this point he already went by the Excellence of Execution moniker. Mm-hmm. How was he doing at this point, you know, as a babyface?
I think both guys are over. I mean, if you watch in the match when Anvil finally gets the hot, because the basic story of this one is they grab Brett and they work Brett over, right? They work his arm. And
did you envision him as a top star, as a potential top star at this point?
At this point, no. No, not
he
at
was,
this point.
He was definitely undersized compared to, you know, the whole roster.
Yeah, no, definitely at this point, I did not think that he would be someone that you would see up again in a main event picture. Although, oftentimes, if tag teams were good, that was a perfect way to build a guy when you did break them up and you could move him up the ladder. But no, he was not someone that I saw at the time as thinking that guy should be in the main event spot or anything like that. He was, to me, he was just a good... Him and Anvil were such a good team together. To me, I just thought, why would you break these guys up? They're so good together. Their promos were good with each other. So I just saw him as a tag team guy at this point.
Crowd starts to really get into it with a number of double team moves from the Hearts. The Anvil, for the finish, the Anvil attacks Mr. Fuji in the corner, who is also accompanying Demolition. And then as Neidhart is attacking Fuji in the corner, the ref is distracted, and Jimmy Hart runs out with his megaphone. Axe takes Jimmy Hart's megaphone and attacks Brett from behind, and Demolition get the win at about 10 minutes.
Yeah, and that was the finish you kind of expect with Jimmy, because when they were heels, that's what Jimmy Hart would do for them all the time, toss the megaphone in an anvil, would cork somebody with the megaphone. So that was kind of the finish that I expected to see, yeah.
We got a Honky Tonk Man backstage now who, Jimmy Hart, I guess, just doing a lot of running on the show.
Between him and Heenan, most of the roster was either one of those guys,
yeah.
Right?
He bolted backstage, I guess, to make this backstage segment, and he's accompanying Honky Tonk Man, who is just livid. I thought he just delivered this fantastic, pissed off promo, upset that of anybody they could have sent. They sent
a warrior.
The warrior.
Yeah.
And Honky Tonk Man calls himself the greatest of all time and vows to get the title back and just destroys the locker room. I thought he was great here.
Yeah, no, it was great. I liked the way they differentiated, and he said, I said I would fight anybody. I didn't say I'd fight a warrior. Yeah. They were kind of playing up that part of it. So, yeah, it was, and well, yeah, again, Honky Tonk Man, awesome on the promos.
Up next, Big Boss Man taking on Coco Beware. Coco Beware, you know,
with Frankie, as Vince Frankie. Used to say, with Frankie. Jesse, look at Frankie.
Big Boss Man here seemed like a guy who was relatively new.
He was. He was. This is basically a superstars match. Mm-hmm. This is basically a squash, except with a guy that's a little bit higher up the ladder in Coco Beware. He had just come into the promotion.
Superstar was really upset that this guy, Boss Man, was wrestling with all this shit, like he's wearing handcuffs and all this stuff on his body.
Yeah, he's got a nightstick, he's got a belt.
And he's like wrestling with a set of keys, and this must have been like actually legitimately, you know, somewhat uncomfortable to wrestle.
Oh, and that whole outfit he had on, I'm sure, was not fun to work in.
But just to even like do any type of like, you know, just imagine those keys scraping your opponent when you're going for that sidewalk slam or something.
Right.
This Bossman basically dominates the whole match. He delivers a splash, the move where he sits on his opponent as he's draped in the middle rope. Bossman then goes up to the top rope. Coco dodges the splash that Bossman attempts. Not a very good looking one, but Bossman lands on his knees, gets back up. Crowd really gets into it for Coco's brief comeback, and he delivers a missile dropkick to Bossman. But then Bossman just delivers his sidewalk slam for the win.
Yeah.
Another jobber match at about 6 minutes.
But again, I don't have a problem with it when it's a new guy. Even if it's a pay-per-view, it's a new guy. Put him out there. Let him, you're building these guys up. I would have no problem on some of these pay-per-views nowadays if you're bringing in someone new to do a squash match on them. You don't think so?
No, I don't know. I really don't know. I think your pay-per-view time should be
all high-end.
I think
but
so.
But wait, when everything's high-end, how do you differentiate anything? Like, so you're saying those should be more on the TV?
I think so.
Like, if you watch NXT, you see genuine squash. You see actually what squash matches
the only exception.
Like.
The only exception I'd make is if it was somebody who was promoted, you know, with already a bit of a name.
And it's maybe his first appearance.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
But I don't know. Maybe this was a different time where this was
I just feel, you know, again, as someone that grew up in that era, I really feel that there should be more of that on Raw, on SmackDown. There should be, when new guys come in, you should have that kind of stuff, because you can't have them just go against big guys in this parody booking. It's no good. I mean, look at what they did this week with Neville and Stardust. Just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Nobody benefits from that parody booking at all. And so you need to have those guys, because you have to show, you have to tell your audience, this is someone you should care about. And when you do those matches like the parody booking, you don't care about anybody.
Ultimate Warrior backstage now, and Warrior, just like the Honky Tonk Man, delivers.
You want to talk about promos, man?
This was a promo.
This was insane. This was classic.
What does he
Warrior talk
about? Tell us.
Well, I had some of the lightning bolts coming down from the sky, and the spaceship taking them back to parts unknown and stuff. Oh yeah, this was classic Warrior.
Warrior's story was that he was waiting for the next spaceship.
Yeah.
In parts unknown.
Yes. But instead, they have spaceships in parts unknown.
Yes, but instead they told him to go to the garden instead and take this title from the Honky Tonk Man. So he did that. And he tells Honky Tonk Man if he wants to come for the title, he'll be on the next spaceship, two parts unknown.
Oh, I loved it. It's just gibberish, just complete gibberish.
Yeah, but awesome.
Yes.
Very awesome. Up next, Hercules versus Jake Roberts.
Not so awesome.
Not as awesome, nope. Superstar Billy Graham on commentary. You know who I realize he sounds like? He sounds just like your impression of Bill Alfonso.
What?
Yeah. Just a lot of daddies.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, he has his crutch words. Like, Graham has his crutch words for sure.
A lot of fast talking, you know. And it was at this point in the show where I was starting to get a bit of a headache from just his constant high energy.
I think it's funny to listen to Graham, because I think the average person would think, oh, he's ripping off Hulk Hogan. He sounds like Hulk Hogan. And it's like, well, no, actually, Hulk Hogan took it all from Superstar Billy Graham, you know? And I think there's some, I always get the Dusty Rhodes thing, too. I think Superstar Billy Graham was influenced by Dusty Rhodes, because that's a lot of it sounds like that Dusty kind of commentary,
definitely.
You know?
So, Jake here, you know, right off the bat, delivers his running knee lift and signals for the DDT, but Hercules escapes out of the ring. A lot of rest holds in this match. Jake first applies a long headlock. Hercules attempts to suplex him out of it, but Jake hangs on to the headlock, even on the ground.
Yes.
I thought that was pretty
cool. I did too. Yeah, that was cool.
Hercules then applies his own reverse chin lock, and this was a bit less interesting. It just seemed like a chin lock that really lasted forever.
Yeah, it's, again, because you don't see it as much nowadays. I mean, Randy Orton is kind of your main guy that likes to do this kind of thing, right? But it was very common back then, all the time.
Well, it just seems like the most comfortable position for
rest. It's an ultimate rest hold, exactly.
The guy on the bottom gets to sit down and lean on a dude's shin.
Right.
The other guy gets to just take a knee.
Yeah, kind of, sort of hold him around the... Yeah, no, absolutely.
Looks very comfortable. Gorilla and Graham try their best to put over this chin lock, saying, you know, while nobody has ever tapped out to a chin lock, but it does signal the beginning of the end.
Ah.
Jake finally fights back with some punches, delivers a short clothesline, then signals for the DDT, but Hercules back body drops out of the DDT and also dodges Jake's running knee lift. Hercules, very limited offense, but seemed agile enough for a large
man. Yeah, again, Hercules was one of those guys that was more about the look and the body and the character. I'm surprised that Heenan didn't come out with him for this
they
match.
They mentioned.
Heenan was his manager at the time.
Right. Jake escapes a scoop slam from Hercules and surprises him with the DDT for the win at 10 minutes.
This is one of those ones where Jake was your classic example, like Steve Austin, in that he's so good at playing a heel that eventually people turned him babyface. Mm. And they Jake used to have his own interview segment called The Snake Pit. And they did a segment with Honky Tonk. And basically, that's when Jake starts to turn babyface. He came out and Honky Tonk corked him with the guitar. And after that, he was a babyface. And people just loved him. You know, they always popped big for the DDT.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Okay, up next we got the Mega Powers and the Mega Bucks in our main event. We first get a bit of a recap of the story,
which was good, you know. Yeah. Especially again, if you're watching this just new or on the network or whatever, I actually enjoyed the way they showed all those clips. I thought that was smart. It's something they should do more often.
Mm-hmm. They still do that for all their main events.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess you're right.
But a real Cole's Notes version. Basically, Savage won the title at WrestleMania in the tournament.
Where both Andre and Hogan went out in one of the early rounds, and the final match was DiBiase against Savage.
So DiBiase basically has recruited Andre now, and there's a segment, a talking segment earlier where basically the two of them attack Savage while Virgil comes in and holds Elizabeth and makes her watch as Andre and DiBiase attack him. Savage then challenges Andre and DiBiase to a tag team match with an opponent to be named later. At this point, Jesse Ventura is assigned as the special guest referee, which DiBiase and Andre are happy about.
Yeah.
And Savage then announces his partner being Hulk Hogan. And then on the Brother Love Show, Jesse is interviewed, and he's threatened by Andre and DiBiase, who we mentioned earlier, shoved that money into his jacket pocket.
Yeah, you get to actually see the clip of DiBiase putting the money in his jacket.
And Jesse gives it a smile. So the story here is Jesse working with...
Exactly, yeah.
The Mega Bucks.
Right.
So then in our main event, Jesse comes out first, not wearing any type of stripes, but instead
he had a white fringe jacket.
Dude, a tasseled white leather jacket.
Yeah. That's classic Jesse.
You're not putting stripes on me.
Classic Jesse.
He's saying. Huge ovation for the Mega Powers coming out to Savage's music. And, you know, how is Savage being in his championship run? How is he being perceived?
Oh, I mean, again, I was not a big Hogan fan, so for me, I loved it because back then I used to get tired of Hogan just dominating the title picture so much. So it was, to me, it was a breath of fresh air. I was very, very happy when they put the belt on Savage. And I think he had a great run as a champion. I mean, he went through they had the great story of him winning it. He had to go through three matches, on that WrestleMania pay-per-view to win the title. So I thought he was doing well, but I'm guessing that Vince always wants to have Hogan, or Hogan himself might have even wanted to be and still be part of that top picture, even though he's not champion.
What I kind of took away from this was, despite, you know, them obviously putting the belt on Savage, it was clearly Hogan who was the top star here.
Yeah, again, we're only 1988, right? He's still a big, big part of the promotion, mm-hmm.
I love the matching outfits.
Yes,
of the Mega Powers, and I don't know how long the Mega Powers actually teamed. How long?
It wasn't long, but because by the next WrestleMania 5, I believe WrestleMania 5, there is the match against each other.
But like to this day, you know, you still see like merchandise for the Mega Powers.
Oh, it's well remembered, Way. Absolutely. And you and John have that unique piece of
Jay
Mega
got
powers.
Us Wrestle Ruse. The underwear with the Mega Powers.
The Mega Powers. That's right. I got Ric Flair.
Yes. They're very comfortable.
Yeah.
Wrestle Ruse. Free plug for those guys. But I just wish teams would do this today more often, or like two main event single stars team up and, you know, get those matching tights, get that name, you know, and I think it's so much more marketable.
You're right. It's not something that I can almost think of seeing since
even
then.
Even like
I mean,
whatever, like Rated RKO. You know, I don't really recall them having necessarily matching
they
outfits.
No, they didn't. They
you
didn't.
Know, they at least had a name.
Yeah.
But
they didn't.
You know,
it doesn't happen. Well, and plus, you got to remember, too, I mean, just until the last little while, tag teams have meant squat to Vince, right? I mean, they really mean nothing. So even, but this was interesting because it puts it past, it makes it more of an attraction. And you don't have to, it's not just a title defense. It doesn't have to be Savage defending the title or anything, right?
This must have been like every kid's dream to see the top two guys in the company.
Right. You know? Oh, for a lot of kids, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So the match early on, we get some teasing of a dissent between Jesse and the babyfaces. Jesse, after speaking with Andre and DiBiase in the corner, decides to change the tag ropes in the corner.
There was all this weird stalling, a lot of weird stalling at the beginning.
I think it was just to convey that he might have been in cahoots with them.
Right.
But so they change corners. Again, very typical formula.
Well, I thought, again, most of the time in this match, you've got Savage and DiBiase in there because they're the workhorses.
That's right.
Right? Like, they can work. God damn, Ted DiBiase, man. He blows. How many of these old matches I watch, he blows my... I remember when I interviewed him, I asked him, I said, how the hell did you do those bumps where you would land on your back and you'd get enough momentum to come swivel on your head and fall in the other direction? Like, his no wonder he had neck problems later on, because his bumping technique was all based around the head and that. But visually... fantastic. Yeah. Looks amazing.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, this might as well have been a handicap match, because Andre really wasn't doing a whole lot at this point.
Oh, he's hurting at this point, right?
Just brief tags, you know, he would come in, step on a guy's head.
Strangle the guy with his...
The pinching of the nerve, which did get a good reaction,
mm-hmm.
the nerve holds. But, I mean, Andre would just tag in, sit on a guy for a bit, and then DiBiase would have to, like, come
absolutely.
Back in, work the whole match. And, you know, just the baby faces take turns getting the hot tag. Hogan comes in and, you know, basically, where are we here? Eventually, Andre and DiBiase toss the Mega Powers out of the ring.
That's right.
Elizabeth and the managers are all on the apron. And the secret weapon
is revealed.
Elizabeth. She's wearing this, like, long dress.
Long yellow kind of dress, yeah.
Stands on the apron. And unzips the dress off.
The bottom part.
The bottom part of the dress off. Let's not get too out of hand. Revealing a shorter skirt. And
a skirt? Why? Whoa, that wasn't a skirt.
Yeah, it was like a...
Like a
bit of a skirt, wasn't it? like a mini skirt?
I guess.
Mini skirt?
Mini, all right.
Mini skirt. Revealing her red bikini bottoms. And somehow this just...
this stops everything.
Immobilized.
This just immobilizes everybody. Exactly.
Paralyzed.
Jesse's staring at him. At her, DiBiase's staring at her. Andre's staring at her. Yeah, it instantly time stops.
You figure the Megabucks here were Mormons or something. They've never seen what's underneath
that dress.
Oh my God, it's a woman's legs.
Yeah.
Help.
Yeah.
So.
I
know this must have been shocking at the time, but I mean, in 2015, this was just so tame.
Yeah, it wasn't that it was shocking way back then. It was more that it was just silly. Just silly. I just kind of thought, oh, this is just silly that Jesse's that immobilized that he's wanted to see that part of Elizabeth for so long or whatever that he just can't do anything. Me and my friends, we just kind of laugh. Because, again, the 80s, a lot of it had a very cartoon comic book kind of feel. And to me, I just thought, oh, my God, this is like a cartoon, you know.
So all four men and the Megabucks are distracted, allowing Hogan and Savage to come in with a blindsided attack. Savage delivers his elbow drop, and then Hogan finishes off with a leg drop on DiBiase. Jesse counts to two and reluctantly makes the third count.
Yeah, yeah.
Savage, you know, even has to grab his hand to complete the pinfall.
Right, that's right, that's right.
The finish took place at about 14 minutes, and your thoughts on the match, Mouth?
Again, Savage and DiBiase carried most of it, right? So when those two are in there together, it's great. Andre and Hogan just kind of did their big spots.
I found the finish, like, really lame. I was expecting Jesse to play a bigger role in the finish. But that said, I thought the match was very fun to watch.
Exactly.
Mainly, I mean, not because of any technical wrestling, but because the characters were so over.
Again, that's a big part of it back then, is characters were so strong, mm-hmm. Way, so strong. You could get away with stuff like this, you know?
And Hogan, you know, like, I think for all the shit people talk about him, I thought he just had a great ability to, you know, draw sympathy from the crowd.
For sure. Although I have to laugh, did you catch at the end when Hogan starts throwing her skirt?
No, I missed
that. Hogan took her skirt, threw it into the crowd. Somebody threw it back, and then he threw it out into the crowd again. That part kind of made me laugh. I'm like, what are you doing? You don't want her to. I guess you don't want her to put the skirt back on.
Who's the person who still has that skirt somewhere?
I know. Would that be amazing? I don't know.
I got Elizabeth's skirt.
I'm trying to remember if it actually made it back to Hogan and stayed there, or if it stayed in the crowd. Because that would be a piece of wrestling memorabilia, that's for sure.
So, you know. I was a little bewildered at Savage's positioning to close the show. Like I mentioned, you know, despite him being the champion, at the sound of the bell, it was Hogan who got the pinfall after his leg drop.
Right.
You know, Hogan even lifts Elizabeth. He lifts Savage's girl.
Right.
Holds Savage's girl.
But see, but that's part storyline way, because that's leading into the breakup of the Mega Power.
Right,
see, you got to remember, back then they were really good at giving you these little hints, right? Even though Savage is fine at this moment, that's the exact thing that triggers it, is that he feels Hogan is too much over Elizabeth. And the other thing we should talk about quickly here is Savage was... He had such, like, in real life, was such control over Elizabeth. Like, he was so insanely jealous. He would make her stay in rooms back in the arena where no one else could talk to her and stuff like that. And to let this angle take place with her taking her skirt off, they must have had to really convince him to do this. Because I, thinking back at the time, I didn't know this, but now with hindsight, I'm watching that going, God, I can't believe Savage ever agreed to this, because he was so protective of her, so protective.
I wonder what they initially proposed, if they had to settle on this.
I don't think it would have been any raunchier than that. Way, it was very kid friendly at that point. So, I mean, I think this. I mean, maybe they were even thinking, hey, we need to put something out there for the fathers that bring their kids, right? Like, who knows what the overall thinking was?
Your overall thoughts on the show, Mouth, and your rating.
What's the rating out of what? 5?
10.
4? 10 out of 10? You know, for an old school show, I don't really think it's that bad. I would, 8 maybe.
Okay, cool. I'd probably give it maybe a 6.5.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not really watching with nostalgic eyes.
Exactly, and I am.
But it's certainly what stands out about the show were the crowds at this time.
And to me, what stands out, characters. How good the characters were. And really, it's great because the characters are so strong, you don't have to kill yourself in the ring. You don't got to be jumping off ladders. You don't got to be going through tables because your character... Like, some of those matches were terrible, but the characters kind of carry the whole thing, you know?
Mm-hmm, for sure. I give the show about a 6.5. And, you know, definitely a very memorable main event. And
the warrior thing, I can't state that, how much that rocket launched his career. That was the point, you know?
Yeah. Was this show any different watching it now than you know, back when you watched it initially, from what you remember?
Well, I didn't have a pitcher of beer and wings in front of me. That was about it. I had been standing in the sun all morning at the garage sale, and then watched it in the afternoon before I went to meet you guys at the House of Hardcore show. So It was definitely different circumstances. And you're right, I am kind of watching it with nostalgia because I grew up in that era. So I'm going to be a little bit more forgiving, I think, than someone watching it nowadays.
Okay, we go to our feedback next. Would you like to join me reading some of this stuff?
Well, go ahead and we can comment on what or
some
whatever.
Some questions for you, I believe, Dan, in this thread. But first we go to Wolf from Mesa, Arizona, who says, This was during my first phase out of pro wrestling after just moving to Arizona after high school and having other interests. I had no idea that longtime AWA vet Baron Von Raschke was ever in the WWF. From his Wikipedia page, he had a brief stint in the WWF in 1988 as the manager for the Barbarian and the Warlord under the name of The Baron, but was released shortly after his arrival, reportedly due to WWF management being bothered by how such a dark heel character was receiving face pops from the crowd.
Well, there you go.
Question for both of us. During this era of WWF, many longtime AWA guys like The Baron received short runs for Vince. One was the Olympian Brad Rengins.
Brad Rengins.
Who went on to train Brock Lesnar and Curtis Axel. In fact, Brad joined Brock on his recent trip to Japan. Are you familiar with Brad Rengins?
I know it's weird spelling. Brad Rengins, I thought was how it was pronounced.
His wrestling career, and do you think WWF could had pulled off a Kurt Angle type gimmick with him back in the mid to late 80s?
Oh, geez. I don't think they were really thinking along those lines. I mean, you got to remember, 80s, Vince was, I mean, a lot of the criticism that Vince got was that he turned it into such a cartoon. And Brad was such a straight, he was a Kurt Angle style wrestler. And at that point in time, and plus he was a smaller guy too. And in the 80s, Vince wanted monsters. Vince wanted big guys and kind of cartoon kind of characters and stuff. So someone like that who really never had a crazy gimmick when he wrestled in the AWA and that, I don't know if they would have really tried to do a serious Olympic wrestler kind of thing.
I'd say it's arguable whether or not he even succeeded with Kurt Angle as a serious Olympic wrestler.
Well, it's true. They turned him into a comedy figure pretty quickly.
For a large portion of his career.
Yeah, no, you're right.
We go to Jesse from Baldwin Village, who says, I can't believe they didn't play the Fabulous Rougeau's entrance music.
I know.
John Pollock must have been rolling over over his grave, by which I mean his couch, watching the G1. At a time in the WWF when subtlety was rare, the Rougeaus had a fairly nuanced gimmick, pretending to love America, but not really. They're perhaps the only people who can't get Americans to chant USA, USA. Question from Mouth. As a fan in the 80s, were you ever disappointed or bemused with great workers from various territories like Dynamite, Brett, Ted DiBiase, who went to the Fed only to work a style that didn't allow them to fully showcase their considerable talent and skill?
Well, again, you have to understand that here, we didn't really get a lot of those guys, the stuff from earlier in their career, because Toronto was one of the first territories for Vince to take over because he already had a bit of a working relationship with the Tunnies. And it was Mid-Atlantic pro wrestling was what was available here before Vince took over. So I saw guys like Steamboat and Flair and Wahoo and Sergeant Slaughter and those guys, but I didn't really get to see a lot of the guys like DiBiase or Hogan or JYD or those guys before they came in. It's only with, you know, these DVDs and stuff coming out now that I've been able to check out some of that stuff. So I was never really... The one that got me was, there was two that really got me back in the day, and that was Harley Race and Dusty. Mm-hmm. When Dusty and Harley came in, I hadn't seen much of them, but the wrestling magazines portrayed these guys as gods, as like, these are like the top guys in the world. And I remember when Harley Race came in and they gave him that king gimmick, and they just treated him like an idiot, and I thought, this Harley Race, this guy's supposed to be like one of the best wrestlers. And same with Dusty, I'm like, this is Dusty Rhodes, and you're putting him in polka dots, and you're making him dance around like an idiot. Those two definitely caught me off guard. But a lot of those other guys, I didn't get to see them. Jake, I didn't get to see those guys before they came into the Fed, so I didn't really have. I might have seen their pictures, like Savage. I remember seeing his pictures in the wrestling magazines. King Kong Bundy, I remember seeing his pictures in the wrestling magazines. Kamala, that was the one I was very excited when he came in because I had seen these pictures in the magazines forever of this guy Kamal, and I really wanted to see what he was like, but most of the time I didn't really have a preconceived notion of the guys because we didn't see them up here.
Up next, we got a Brad from Whitby who says, guys, it was a happening. While there were, really was a-
You got to remember, that was one of Gorilla Monsoon's crutch phrases. You go back to any old, especially those big pay-per-view shows with Gorilla, first thing out of his mouth is, it's a happening.
It's a happening.
Yeah, yeah.
There really isn't too much to say about the event, really just a couple of decent tag matches. An 8.5 rated bear hug. Off of Bearhugger.net
okay.
From Ken Patera.
Oh, right. 8.5. Gee, 8.5, that's pretty good.
Not bad. A quick title change and Miss Elizabeth looking stunning. A couple questions. Dan, I've always wanted to know, how does a closed captionist do his job or their job? Do you have to watch every show and then type stenographer style, or is there a script provided? Could you have captioned the Ultimate Warrior promo you heard on the show?
Yeah, oh yeah, I could have captioned it. The way it works, it's really basic, simple, and it's kind of both of those things that you said there.
And that is Dan's day job, for people
yes.
who don't know.
Yeah, there's a great computer program now called Softel, which allows you to have a screen where you can type and you have your video uploaded. And what you do when you're doing a show from scratch is, yeah, you just sit and stop and start. You listen to a bit, you type it out, and then you start it up again, you type it out. And then I tend to transcribe the whole thing first, and then you go through and you time it so that the captions will appear at the right moments. And you do it to the time code.
Right.
You time it to the time code of the show, right?
Have you tested your words per minute?
That was part of the job interview.
And what did you have to get?
You had to have 70 words a minute or more, and I got the job. So, and I've been doing it for 10 years, so I think I'm actually faster now.
Wow.
So, yes, I could have done. I haven't had to do much pro wrestling. I had to do Hulk Hogan's Micro Championship Wrestling, which was horrible. But back when TNA first started doing their one night only shows, we got one of them, and they didn't send it captioned, and I had to do that. It drove me insane. I had to fucking take note of every fucking thing Taz said. I had to, because you have to hang on every word. You have to transcribe what they're saying. That's the job. And it fucking drove me insane, because Taz, he's the worst fucking commentator ever. And it just, that was the one time it drove me nuts. And we do get scripts sometimes to work with. Sometimes you can cut and paste and use the script. Other times the script is just handy for reference for people's names. Because a lot of times if you're captioning some documentary about World War II, you might not know all the people's names or the Japanese names and stuff like that. So it's nice to have a script that helps you kind of, you know, figure all that kind of stuff out without having to do too much research online.
Yeah. We recently started putting the review of Raw on TV here at the channel. And as part of that, our shows have to be closed captioned here.
They probably caption it live, I'm guessing.
They caption it, yes, they do. Yeah. They do it in one of these rooms right here.
Yeah, a lot of television, especially even if it's pre-recorded, but a lot of sports-oriented stuff and that kind of stuff, it's always done live.
Yeah.
And actually, even most of the big primetime series in the States, because they're working on the show so close to deadline that they don't have time to get it captioned in advance. And even some of the big end dramas, they'll caption them live.
And I couldn't tell you like how incredibly bizarre it was to walk into a room and just see a guy. It's all like voice controlled. The live closed captioning, at least in our place.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
oh.
Actually, you maybe check it out.
Because you know what they used to do, I think some of them still do, is for live captioning they give you a different keyboard. It's not your standard keyboard. They give you the same
stenographer.
Right, what a court keyboard. Stenographer would use, with all the less buttons and lots of shortcuts and you know combinations of buttons or whole sentences and things. Right.
But going back to that, it was so incredibly bizarre walking into this room and seeing a dude repeat my words that I'm talking right now.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking that anybody's going
right.
to scrutinize my words and try to replicate my words and print it on screen. It was the weirdest thing. You know, like I could be talking now and me saying like bubblegum. Bubblegum, bubblegum.
Yeah.
Like somebody would have to print that out. It's the most bizarre thing.
The other thing, too, you have to watch, and I find a lot of shows, they don't do this, and it just makes it too much to read, is you can't caption everything. People cannot read as fast as people can talk.
Mm-hmm.
And some shows, if someone says, oh, yeah, yeah, oh, this, like they'll try to get every oh, yeah, they'll try to get every ah in there, and it's like, you can't do that. You have to edit them. You have to make it, if it's going to go by at a fairly quick speed, you've got to make it so that people can read it. That's the main thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll have to, unfortunately, speed through some of this feedback
sure.
here. But up next, we got Hacksaw Jim Powers, Chris in Ottawa, who says, "Hey fellas, everything after SummerSlam 88 is when I became cognizant of professional wrestling being a thing. The explosion of the Mega Powers is the first wrestling story I can remember. It was right around the time the Roller Games was a thing. Boy, that was a great show and an even better pinball game. Mouth knows what I'm talking about, right, Mouth?
The SummerSlam pinball machine?
Yeah.
Is that what he means?
Or the Roller Games? I don't know.
Oh, I remember Roller Games, yeah.
We go to Ronaldo from Milan. Average show, but the main event got the best reaction you could ask for back at the time. The wrestling was what it was, but when I was a kid, that was the bread and butter of my childhood." John Casey wants to know if Brutus was actually going to face Honky that evening, or if it was supposed to be Warrior the whole time.
Oh, I don't know for sure. That would be a good question for someone like Dave Meltzer. But my belief is yes, it was probably. I think they realized how hot Warrior was. A program with Beefcake and Honky Tonk was really going nowhere, anyways. Mm-hmm. Although his program with Outlaw Ron Bass didn't go anywhere either. But I honestly think that at some point they must have realized, hey, man, this guy's hot. If we do this, they'll attach the rocket to him. Because they're definitely trying to create a new star.
So that wraps up our feedback. Thank you all for paying attention and watching this show. And thank you, Dan, for coming
on.
Hey,
no problem, Way. Anytime you want. I always have a great time. I have something for you.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to do this on the podcast.
What do you have? Oh, sweet.
As many of you know, Way and I are big fans of comic books. And Way, you know, me being the old man and Way being the youngster, I try to educate the young children on the stuff they might have missed. I gave them a bunch of Dead Man comics at Christmas.
Yes, which I enjoyed.
From the 70s. And you and I were talking about the Hulk or something a while ago. And I mentioned to this you. And when I was cleaning out for the garage sale, I found this. And I have two copies. So this is for you. And to me, this is the best Hulk story ever done. It's called Banner. The artwork's by Richard Corbin, who is amazing. I discovered him when I was in the early 80s. He used to do a whole bunch of horror comics, Twisted Tales and Alien Worlds. And it's written by Brian Azzarello, who did 100 Bullets. And honestly, I think it's one of the best Hulk stories ever. And if this happened in real life with the Hulk, this book to me conveys, I think, what would happen in reality.
What is the synopsis? What's the concept?
It's basically you have this guy that's become this monster, and this is how he deals with it.
So is it a retelling of the origin?
Or? No. It's just kind of putting it in a different context. To me, again, it's kind of taking it out of the superhero, supervillain realm and putting it in the real world. Like, there's no villain, there's no supervillain in this. It's really about Banner trying to contain the Hulk. And they also make it much more, again, what you would expect in real life without giving, I don't want to give too much of it away to you.
Awesome.
But I think you'll love Corbin's artwork.
Yeah, the art looks
Corbin
awesome.
Has a really super unique style. Like, you can spot it right away.
It's not really like superhero. It's more like American Splendor type of.
Oh, is that what, yeah? He got his start doing tons of horror. There was a company, I forget what the company was called, but they did a comic called Twisted Tales, Alien Worlds, and Corbin usually did. He did a lot of the artwork in those. I like it. Like, it's a thick, very thick line. More of, you know, not,
yeah,
not
like
it's
it.
Not like a well-defined George Perez, Brian Boland, really linear. It's much more big shadows and colors and blocks. And I think you'll really dig it. And it was a four-issue miniseries,
yes.
Right? And then they just compiled it. And I have another copy, so that's yours.
Thank you very much. Awesome. I love getting comics.
Well, and I think you're going to really like it.
Thank you very much. I will enjoy that. I'll probably read that today.
That's the other thing. It's a quick read.
What else are you checking out while we're on the topic?
Comic book wise?
Yeah. Have you heard of are you familiar with the Squadron Supreme?
The old one.
Yes.
Like when it first started back in like the 80s or 90s. But I haven't read any of the recent ones.
They're a recent discovery for me. And for people who don't know what the Squadron is,
they're doing a movie, right?
No, they're not doing that. You're probably thinking Suicide Squad, right? But the Squadron Supreme are basically. They started off as Marvel's parody of the DC Comics JLA.
Right.
And so you have, you know, this guy named Hyperion who's also, who's basically, you know, has the same origin story as Clark Kent, Superman.
Right, right.
But except they started off as villains in the Avengers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm reading
so this is the current adaptation, or is this going?
There have been so many adaptations of
different
versions
of
Squadron Supreme
okay.
in recent years. I just picked up one from our friend Mike's store, BMV.
Yep.
I picked up the whole series for like $12.
Right.
Of their, have you heard of Marvel Max?
No.
Max is like sort of their Vertigo, or their attempt at Vertigo.
Yep, yep.
Just sort of a more
adult,
mature readers stuff. And so, what is it? JMS, J. Michael Straczynski.
Mm-hmm.
He did his version of the Squadron Supreme. And really, it's just like, I'm starting to read it, and it's pretty awesome, because it's really just like a Marvel version of like, you know, the Justice League and him doing like his origin story of the JLA.
Interesting.
And what he would do with the JLA, but
right.
without any type of like clutter, without any type of backstage.
Oh.
You know.
Yeah, interesting.
Ties.
Interesting.
So that's what I'm reading lately.
No, that sounds great. I mean, a comic book store in my neighborhood recently closed down, and they had a huge sale, and I went friggin' nuts. I just bought tons of stuff. But I read some of the Mark Waid Daredevil, which I thought was awesome. I want to get some more of that. Mark Waid also did some Hulk stuff recently, and I got some of those books, so I'm looking forward to going through. I really love Mark Waid. I think he's just such a clever writer. And after Kingdom Come, I really got hooked on his style. And I love he's been given rein almost to try most of my favorite heroes. So I've been trying to hunt down all the different stuff that Mark Waid's done through the years with the guys that I like.
Yeah. He's been known to, especially recently, he spent a lot of time on Daredevil.
Mm.
And I think what was notable about his Daredevil, you know, there are a lot of people just discovering Daredevil now.
Right.
Because of the TV
yes.
show.
But, which was fantastic.
You know, the TV show is like very dark, like exactly like the Marvel version of Batman.
Mm-hmm.
But Mark Waid's Daredevil was, because like Daredevil had been so dark, you know, with Frank Miller.
He lightened it up.
He turned it into like, he almost brought it back to like the 60s version.
Not quite.
Of
not
Bat-
quite.
Not quite. But it almost like, you know how Batman used to be like sort of a comedy, you know,
well,
Adam West type of thing?
Well, yeah. Well, the comics were kind of like that, but the comics still took themselves seriously. But then once the TV show got popular, the comics started to be really campy.
Right. But, you know, this was almost that in reverse.
Yeah.
Where Mark Waid kind of turned Daredevil.
I agree.
Into
I liked
like a
it.
Light but fun and pretty, you know, awesome sort of, you know, more of a more cartoonish type of
Yeah,
character.
The dark period in comics was great, but I think it went on a little too long, and I think it's kind of worn itself out, and I'm really happy to see guys like that. That's why I like the Flash TV show so much, because it's a little bit more lightweight, and it's not just all doom and gloom, and the hero's a psychotic mess, And same with, even with the new Daredevil, like you say, it was dark, but it wasn't that I'm a dark, brooding psychotic. It was, it's dark because it's in Hell's Kitchen and it's a grim situation and that. Like, I'm really tired of the brooding, dark, psychotic hero. I think it was a great area to explore, and I'm glad they did, but I think they need to kind of.
But it's been
on.
Like 20 years of that.
I know.
Actually, 30 years.
That's
probably.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It needs to be. They need to chill out a little bit. I understand how that really did revitalize comics with The Dark Knight and all that, but you got to kind of step back a little bit sometimes too, right?
If you want to hear us talk more about comic books, feel free to message us privately. We could talk about this stuff.
Oh, I know, exactly.
Find us on Facebook, whatever. We won't take up too much of people's time. Or also on the message board.
Yeah, yeah. No, sorry, I just wanted to give you that
Thank you
on
so
the
much.
Podcast.
Thank you so much for doing that. But before we... What should we watch next week? What should John and I review next week?
Well, when you originally approached me for this one, I suggested this one, and I would love to hear you and John do one of the old classic Ring of Honor shows where we've got Because you go through some of them. The promotion started in 2002. You go back around 2003, 2004, and, man, they're all there. CM Punk is there. Samoa Joe is there. Daniel Bryan is there. Seth Rollins is there as Tyler Black. I mean, Jimmy Jacobs, who's now working WWF Creative. I mean, so many of what we see, Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, so many of these guys that we see as really getting the big push and being the top guys now, were all in Ring of Honor back in the day. And I thought it would be fun for you guys to pick one of the older shows and let some of the fans know about, you know, what some of these, because they might not even know about the history of some of these guys, right? I mean, it's only just with NXT and that we're starting, that they actually are letting guys talk about their old, that would never have happened in the 80s. Never in a million years would you acknowledge the guy being anywhere else. Yeah. You know, he was here, he's nowhere.
That is a great choice, and I'm very happy to kind of duck out of the WWE, you know, WCW bubble for a little bit. And we are going to go to the request thread at lawradio.proboards.com, and I think we'll do Final Battle 2010, which
okay.
should probably be a show that isn't that difficult to find for people out there. And this, of course, features the unsanctioned fight without honor for El Generico's mask.
Yeah.
Versus Kevin Steen leaving ROH. This is El Generico versus Kevin Steen.
Yeah, this was, and that was like one of the classic Ring of Honor feuds there, right? Like those two, they were a tag team, and then they broke up. They feuded for like an entire year, entire year, and it was good. So yeah, I mean, just looking at this card, yeah, because look, there's Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens in the main event, you know. The Briscoes are always fun. It's always fun to watch the Briscoes. There's Chris Hero, who we just saw at, and Cesaro is in there as Claudio Castagnoli. Like, it's great. Homicide, Christopher Daniels, you know, Colt Cabana's in there. Great stuff, man. Great stuff.
Very much looking forward to the show. So, watch this, seek it out if you can, and leave some feedback next week. And, Mouth, thank you for joining us.
No problem, Way. Anytime.
I would ask you where people could find you on Twitter, but you are one of the few people who are still.
If they can take the spaceship to parts unknown, they can find me.
Well, are you on Periscope, though?
I don't even know what that is.
John's favorite app.
Oh, I have no idea what it is. I've never even heard of it.
All right. Well, you are on Facebook, at least.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
So send Dan Lebransky a friend request. Chat pro comic books with him.
Exactly. Yes.
And. I don't think we even go out with music anymore. So,
oh no,
we should go out with a promo though. So, what was a notable promo on the show? It could even be
I would play the Warrior one.
Done.
Yeah, play the Warrior one because it's over the top.
We're gonna hop onto our spaceship
and out to parts unknown.
And thanks for listening.
And Warrior, you are now a champion of the World Wrestling Federation.
Honky Tonk Man, you thought it was something like out of a comic book, brother, but we're talking about real life. I was sitting in parts unknown, waiting for the next spaceship. The higher planes, and the lightning bolts came down from the skies, and the Warrior spoke, and they said, make it to the garden. Well, the Ultimate Warrior showed, and Honky Tonk Man, you gave the challenge, and the Ultimate Warrior, and the little warriors with all the painted faces, rose to the challenge, and they conquered. I'm taking all the little warriors through all the darkness and all the pain, and Honky Tonk Man, if you want a piece of me, or anybody thinks, they can take on all the warriors. I'm not hard to find. I'll be on the next spaceship to parts unknown.